Thank you for joining us to another installment of Identaholics. My name is Christine Owen, and I am your host today. And today we have an amazing person. I'm so excited that we have him with us. We have Ross Ford, who recently retired from 15 years, is that right, of service with the government, or is it longer, Ross?
Well, including the time in the Navy, it was just about 20 years.
Wow, just about 20 years. That's amazing. And during those 20 years, you've actually done really quite amazing things. And I actually went to LinkedIn and I saw your retirement post, and I saw you had over 188 comments. Wow. So one of the things that I want to talk about today is all of the really cool things that you got to do that were impactful with the government, because I think that government service is really important and people need to understand all the things that one can do with the government and how you can actually make quite a big ripple and impact, which you absolutely have done. So let's start off by, how did you end up in the identity realm?
I kind of ended up in the identity realm as I entered the third career in my life. So I had started out as a submariner. I learned nuclear engineering and worked on a submarine. That took me to work in a manufacturing environment where they allowed me to get I worked shift work, and I got a computer engineering and electrical engineering degree. So I was hired by a telecommunications company who was just moving from analog to digital in the late 90s. And they asked me to stand up a knowledge management portal for them. And so I did that. Netscape Publisher was the first system that you could actually publish web content on. And so I put tens of thousands of engineering documents that documented their digital systems on that site. And then I went to the program managers. I'm like, okay, so who do you want me to give access to this stuff, right? And he was like, oh no, we just want to publish it on the web. And I said, no, you don't understand. If you publish this information on the web, anybody that can get to it, I mean anybody, it's just published, right? So we worked on, how do you do that? You got to give an LDAP, and you put some server, you have to give people passwords, they're going to log in. And so at that point in time, that's when I realized that, you know what? People really don't understand the impact of these web technologies. And so I tried ever since then, that was probably 1998, tried to focus on identity technologies as much as I could. That was a little difficult to do. Not a lot of places were really doing, identity and access management. Most enterprises are doing some kind of authentication anyway, using passwords. But that's how I initially got into the identity and access management space.
That's pretty amazing, because now I understand why you know Sean Frazier, because he was around Netscape back then. I mean, besides the fact it's Sean
Yeah.
Frazier, and it's you, but that's really funny. So, and then you ended up, I know that you went in and out of the government. So you went in once and then you left a little bit and then you went back in. So what were you doing the first time around?
So the first time I joined the government, and I think I'll give a little bit of this story because it helps people understand how you really need to be persistent when you're trying to get a government job. I when After I left that job at Motorola, I worked for what would be considered a cloud company, right? So it was US Internet Networking was the name of the company. They were an application service provider, and that was in 2000. So we really early building some, web-based business applications and everything. Well, they went bankrupt, and I was living in Chicago. That company was out of Annapolis, but I was actually running their Midwest business. And so I decided to come back to DC area, where my family's from, where I was born anyway. So when I got here, I applied for a job. People wanted me to do this. It was an identity access manager thing for something that CBP was doing to modernize one of their big systems. And I went and interviewed, and I thought everything went really well. And then I didn't hear anything for the very long time. And I kind of figured, well, I guess I didn't make the cut on that. So I was working on another project that one company had, and I got a call on the phone. And it's like, "And hey, Mr. Ford, I wanted to let you know your background investigation was completed." And I'm like, "What? Yeah, do you remember meeting?" And they named the guy and the place. And I said, "Yeah, that was about a year ago." And they said, "Well, your background investigation got completed, and now you can come work here as a contractor." And I was really surprised, right, that it took a year for me to get through that. And it was fortunate that I was actually available then. The project I was working on was coming to an end. So that's how I started. I started as a contractor working for CBP, and then I ended up working at ICE. So and ICE was a really That was a really big deal for me, because ICE was considered the SSO steward for DHS. So there was this thing in that era that was like 2007, 2008. E-authentication was the thing that the government is trying to do. It was a federation capability. And so at ICE, we were the SSO steward, and we helped the agency as the steward, implement single sign-on. And then I moved from there. Well, actually, the principals that were working there, I moved to another agency. And so they asked me to become a govvie. And I happily did that. I worked at ICE for a while. And then that whole capability, because it was successful, it moved to DHS headquarters to manage. And I moved over there as the first DHS ICAM architect at DHS, which was really that was a great time. I had really enjoyed doing that and had a good impact. DHS is a great agency to work for. And then we were kind of complete with that mission, right? So the single sign-on, it was in a system we called APOTH, is what we were using. And so we were pretty much mission complete. The DHS was completing implementing HSPD 12, the smart card across DHS, and that SSO service helped people to log into the network with that. There wasn't any activities that they were funded, so I went ahead and went out to the industry for a while, worked for a couple of organizations, most notably for Oracle for a while.
And then after that, you came back in the CISA, right?
I did. So I'll tell you a little story about how that happened. I went to an identity management conference. I can't remember which one it was. And I guess it was in 2015. And I saw a mentor of mine, Jim Quinn, who really had been the person that had been mentoring me all the time at DHS. And he was talking to DHS. It was after the OPM breach, and the government knew they needed to do something to really keep that kind of event from happening again. I didn't know exactly what they were going to do, but I told Jim, I said, "Look, I would come back to the government to help solve that problem, right? To keep that from happening again." And a couple of months later, he said, "Hey, there's a job posting you might be interested in." And I went ahead and went to USA Jobs, did the thing, did the posting. CISA called. They actually interviewed me for one position first that I wasn't a great fit for. And then finally they interviewed me for the ICAM position on what they called phase two at CDM. And it was a great fit for that. And I came back in and worked with CDM. And the whole time I've been at CISA, from that was a March of 2016 till now, I've been supporting CDM. But it's been progressing, right? So CDM was the first place I worked. And then we formed a larger group at CISA called the Architecture and Engineering Center of Excellence. And that's when I retired, that's where I was working for Branko Bokun at the COE.
So let me ask you, when you got into the government the first time versus the second, was it faster to get in? Because the CISA had different hiring allowances then, right?
It was faster for me to get in the second time than the first, because I had already, they had to do the gap between when I left the government, but I'd been working in regulated industry, so I had a pretty they could look things up, always doing secret stuff and everything, right? So it wasn't that hard. It took me a few months and then I got in. They would have liked to have had me in even faster because they really had a couple of task orders that were ready to go. The cred management and the priv management task orders. But hey, it was just a few months, and that's really lightning speed in the federal space.
Yeah, and it's really good, and it's a credit too. I really do feel like a lot of that, they figured out how to fix that after the OPM breach, right? So the before it would take at least a year for anyone to try to get into government from time of application to start date. And then they realized like, oh, cybersecurity is important. So they kind of started fast tracking cyber jobs, which has been very helpful. And they do a decent job of attempting to match salaries when you're coming in from outside as well as they can within the GSLA scale or GS scale, right? So
Yeah, I was fortunate, and I don't think it was a small thing that I may have come back anyway, but I knew that CISA had some incentives, right? Retention and hiring incentives, and so I took advantage of those. And CISA is really one of the DHS and CISA both are leading in trying to modernize the workforce, the type of workforce, how we hire, how we retain people, really, really to get the best folks. And I think it's working for them.
yeah, I think so too. So the CDM program was a really big program. It still is. It even though it like we're getting into the smaller agencies, I actually think CDM is going to be pretty amazing for them once it really starts helping with the small and the micro agencies. But what do you think? Because it did change the way that agencies contracted with products, especially cybersecurity and ICAM products. So, what do you think was one of the biggest impacts and the biggest takeaways from that program when you were there?
There's really a number of different things that I want to call out. The first is just, that trying to help agencies across the federal realm focus on important themes is really important, right? So, and some of it's really hard to do. So in CDM first starting, they were trying to help people get a handle on their assets and their environment. And it was more difficult for agencies to understand what assets they actually had on the network than one might think, right? Some agencies were reporting through CyberScope they had, this number of assets, and then when CDM put some tools in to actually scan the network and look for them, they might have had 50%. They might have been knowing about 50% of them, right? So it was really important to get in and using the network itself to understand what is on the network, right? I think similar to understanding the network posture for assets like devices, understanding the humans on the network are really important too. And so that was one of the things that we did with the cred management and the priv management part. And I think the most important aspect of that is what we already knew in working with big organizations outside the federal government is you really need to take an enterprise view of your workforce, right? You need to know who the people in your organization are. A lot of organizations had many different Active Directory services running around. The federal government was actually advantaged by the fact that we had, the IDMS systems, the systems that the HSPD-12 regime uses to make sure that people get cards and then they know who is authorized to work on this system. But what CDM did with the Master User Record is have a place that all those users could be operationally recognized, right? And so that was really important. The other thing, and this is directed about the cyber sprint, is privileged users were really needed to have focus on them, right? And while a lot of agencies were using their PIV cards for some of their privileged users, a lot of places that you want to be able to give privileged access, PIV cards didn't support it, right? So we were able to bring in some other tools to help agencies bridge that gap, where they can use their smart card to log into the privileged access management tool, and then the privileged access management tool can manage the secret, which is the only thing you can log into many of these systems using, right? And then you can rotate those secrets so that you don't have static long-lived secrets that pose really a big risk in the environment.
So do you think that the rise of so that I like you're giving me flashbacks because I completely forgot. I wasn't even thinking about this, but CDM definitely started, when there was a huge push, right, to get PIV cards into federal employees and contractors, mainly because of the OPM breach. And after that, I was helping out GSA at the time, so it was taking a long time for us to convince the agencies, and then they finally started to say, okay, but then they said, now what do we do with this? Do you think that the rise of modern authentication helped PIV card adoption with the way that the basically the allowance of SSO and authentication throughout?
It's kind of been a mixed bag. The modern authentication techniques that have been emerging have been coming from people that don't generally utilize smart cards as authentication basis, right? So we've had to work with industry to realize that if you're working in the federal government, we have this smart card, so you need to integrate this smart card into your SSO services, right? But it is definitely true that modern authentication SSO services are superior to the SAML-based authentication services that really were built, and they were pretty well built out in some systems. SAML-based services using the smart card. So it's an interesting transition that's occurring from the SAML-based assertion model to what I call a more flexible and authorization-based single sign-on model that Open Identity Connect can provide with the OAuth2 underpinnings, right? We've just begun to kind of touch on those capabilities. I can see the industry is struggling with a lot, right? In that they're trying to figure out how to add authorization into their single sign-on and their identity services as a particularly for most of the industry as they're trying to deal with partners and citizens coming into their systems. And there's a strong drive in that direction, right? With modern, all auth-based authorization, claims-based models, with the citizens, that involves having consent, right? And trying to use larger scale login systems like logging with Google or logging with Apple. Those things are what we see emerging in the consumer space. But not so much in the federal space, right? Because we need a higher level of assurance, generally speaking, for those. Now, those technologies will be beneficial to the enterprise as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I also am now realizing it was a completely different light timeline back when I met you and I started doing IAM. But CDM really had a lot of they had a lot of on-prem solutions, and now I feel like CDM has mostly cloud solutions, right? And what I'm thinking of is the agencies that I know that have gotten bought from CDM recently, all of those things have been cloud-based solutions. So what do you think about that? Do you think that's helping the cybersecurity posture of the federal government? And how do you think that that's going to impact us as a whole moving forward?
I want to talk about a little bit of inside baseball at CDM, in that CDM is it's not only a program that helps deliver services, but it has an acquisition arm, and that acquisition arm is really a brilliant bunch of people. Nikki has been able to make sure that as CDM modernizes the way it delivers services to agencies, that the type of services they acquire can meet that modernization. So I'll give you an example, right? So, like you said, CDM started out, we're trying to protect agencies. It's the legacy environment is primarily where those agencies reside, and the things we did are appropriate for that, right? And then as you move into other types of delivery, and I'll say the first one was these endpoint detection and response tools, which are necessarily delivered mostly by the cloud service providers. And we're able to flex into being able to acquire those kind of services for people. And then just in general, that as you see the drive towards zero trust architectures, the delivery model of the services that support zero trust architectures are much greater focused on cloud-based services than on the legacy environment. And CDM, all the time continues to modernize, their approaches to doing those things to match that kind of, what system delivery model. And Nikki Lane, like I said, she is, she's one of the smartest ladies I've ever met. She is tremendous at helping CDM navigate its way through acquisition processes, which, if you know, they're not always the most advanced things you can do. But I will tell you that CDM continues to win awards about being, on the cutting edge of acquisitions, and they'll continue to do that because that's where the threat is moving to, and so CDM has to move just like, just to be able to be effective, and they are doing that. And then Matt House, who, he's the CDM program manager now, Rich Grabowski, the deputy program manager and the kind of the lead architect, they both have had a lot of experience with service delivery. Now they've been doing that through, like I mentioned, EDR parts of CDM, network access control parts are moving in that direction. And I'll also say that you mentioned earlier the small latencies. So CDM has been delivering service to small latencies ever since, its inception, right? And it does this in a service delivery model. And that service delivery model has been evolving as the capabilities become more cloud focused as well. So I think you and that is actually a really good place to try a lot of new things out in the small services. And the small agencies need the help, right? Because often they have very small IT teams and they need to have really good help from competent providers in order to meet their security needs.
Yeah, and what's really interesting that I've seen in the government is some of the small agencies actually have some of the biggest missions that we don't even know about,
Oh, they
right?
do. Exactly right. You think they may have really, they're small agencies, but they have a big mission, and the information they support is really can be very sensitive, right? So yeah.
Yeah, it's really impressive. So, all right, so I like see some really cool awards behind you. So I see the DHS seal. So I assume that's your retirement seal. And then you have a really cool plaque. What are those? I feel like this is like your career in the government as a whole.
So the top is I was a plank owner for the USS Buffalo, which was a submarine, and I'm really proud of that. That was a great place. Actually, the reason I'm a good engineer, if I am that, is because of having been in the Navy, and they taught such quality and excellence in that organization as a submariner. I mean, I owe everything to being to having started my career there, right? And then DHS gave me opportunity with this SSO stewardship, which was really very unique. And I was recognized by Director Morton and the CIO for having put that SSO thing together for DHS. And I'm really proud of those activities. They were really fundamental to establishing me as an engineer and then as an ICAM engineer, right? And I want to say that being that ICAM engineer has allowed me to work in so many different areas, right? I mean, I'm working for the Federal Mobility Group on the Mobile Security Working Group to help organizations and agencies understand how mobility is taking the lead in our identity space now, right? Being on the federal ICAM subcommittee, because I was pretty smart in this space, that when CISA needed to join, that Jen asked me to be that, and I was really happy to be there. I gotta say, in the industry, my reputation, I guess, is pretty good because I was asked to join the FIDO Alliance's Identity Management Working Group, and that was really a great experience too, because all the best vendors that are serving identity in the federal space have been working with ATARC, and ATARC's done a really great job not only in identity management, but the Zero Trust Working Group of bringing industry together, showing how this can be actually implemented. So agencies don't just have to kind of like, do this as a thought exercise. They can actually look at how some of these systems come together. And none of that would have been possible if I hadn't, spent time in the ICAM space, which allows you to get connected to so many different to different, different kinds of systems and different themes.
Yeah, I think you definitely hit it on the net on the head the nail on the head there, because I'm definitely very active in FIDO, and I was active in ICAMSI when I was a consultant with the government. But what I find is that not just agencies, even companies, they work in silos when it comes to ICAM and identity and access management, and they don't understand that actually, if you start talking to your vendors probably know other companies or organizations that have had the exact same problem that you have, and they can put you to and talk to other people, and you can start getting a broader view. Even though you don't have the same systems, you can still start figuring out like what is the best way forward. Just because it worked for that organization doesn't mean it'll work for yours, but at least you'll start getting really good ideas to like get unstuck. That's what ICAMSI 100% does, and I think it's really important for the federal government. But you also get that when you are in those other cooperative working groups that are public private a cooperation, because both sides have seen a lot, and learning from each side to be able to like bring better, stronger cybersecurity managers is really important.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So, all right. So now this is not the end of your road, though. All right. So you're retiring just from the government. You're not fully retiring. So I'm going to start by asking you, what's the one thing, or it's probably, I would probably, let's try to do a handful of things, because I know a lot of things keep you up at night, and it's not just one. But what do you see on the horizon as the next big threats to the US infrastructure?
So I want to give a shout out to Dr. Garfield Jones, Gary Jones, who, so last year, Gary used to be the lead engineer at CDM, and he's now leads the strategic technologies at the Office of Strategy, Policy, and Plans at DHS. And we kept in touch. We're really good friends and colleagues, right? So he knew I was looking for new challenges. Not that identity is not exciting, but it was only filling up part of my brain and I needed to fill up others. So I got a chance to go work on a detail with Gary last year for about 4 months. So much I can't work. I couldn't spend more time in that, but I was able to do that. And there are so many things that I was able to explore when I was working with Gary. First I want to say is, Gary knew that machine learning and artificial intelligence were really important to me. And when Gary got his doctor in machine learning a few years ago, we talked a lot about the things he was going through to make sure he put together his thesis properly and defended it well. He's a brilliant guy, and I'm really happy about that. So we got a chance, a little bit of chance to talk about, ML and AI while I was over there. The other thing that Gary knew I was really interested in is when I was a nuclear engineer, I first became aware of quantum mechanics because quantum mechanics actually are what make the nuclear reactor work. And so, it's like that is way long time ago, and then nothing, nothing, nothing. And now quantum mechanics is emerging to become really important, specifically in sensor technology right now. But everybody's working really hard to build a quantum computer. And I'll say quantum computers of various natures, right? You have a friend of yours who, is building a certain type of quantum computer, trapped atoms computers or atoms in matrix, which is, that's one type that is actually easier to control than the ones they've been trying to build for 20 years, right? So there's a lot of things that are emerging there. But that's probably too far out for me to really worry about doing in my next phase of my life. But one thing that is very interesting is that as these quantum computers emerge, cryptography will probably fall fairly early as they build larger scale quantum computers, because asymmetric cryptography is vulnerable to a cryptographically relevant quantum computer, is what they call it, right? And asymmetric cryptography is what we base all of our encryption and our digital signatures on. So there's an immediate need now. And I worked with Gary to help explore what those things are. And that might be some place that, would scratch the itch that I have to do things. But there's others too, right? I mean, even in the ICAM arena, on CDM, we had some agencies asking about non-person entities, right? So there's a lot of humans that operate on the network, but there's a heck of a lot more non-humans that are doing things in our world. And if we bring in these artificial intelligence agents, right, there are agents that are operating in ever-increasing responsibility on the network. And I think helping people get a handle on how to identify the workloads that are doing things in their environment, they're not going to be managed the exact same way human identities are. You're like identity proofing. Yeah, you're going to have to do something different for workloads and machines, right? But there probably needs to be a corollary to that in the machine space. I really am excited. Justin Richer, who is one of the guys that works with NIST and all their ICAM stuff, he and some other folks like Dean Sachs from the FIDO Alliance and a whole bunch of guys have formed this WIMSI group, which is, it's workload identity management. And so I think that, that's one of the things that I'm following. One of the challenges when you're in the government, you don't have that much opportunity to participate on so many cool things. I was lucky to be on the FIDO Alliance and ATARC, but this will give me an opportunity to be a little closer to that. And I just want to say that the OpenID Foundation also has, initiatives about managing machine and non-human workload identities too. So that's an area of a lot of interest to me. And I think on any given day, I can spend 10 minutes thinking about what is cool in this world. And there's just so much, stuff that is coming down the pike. I think our world is going to be changed forever just by the fact that we're living in a digital world. And all the things that we learned, how to live in our physical world together nicely, such as it is, will be have to be translated into the digital world, right? And that it, to me, that is just really exciting. And I don't know what's going to be next, but I guarantee it's going to be something exciting. And hopefully it'll have really good outcomes.
Yeah, I think first off, I think I read this week that the federal government is supposed to be releasing their post-quantum plan soon, like within like this summer, definitely by the end of the fiscal year. So I think that that's going to be something that's really important that everyone reads, not just vendors, but also implementers, because everybody uses this cryptology, right? Literally everyone. It's a
Everybody.
signing cert, it's everywhere. So we have to understand how to go and kind of shore up our systems for post-quantum for sure. What's really interesting is what's keeping me up at night. I know you didn't ask me, Ross, but I'm gonna tell you. What I think our biggest threat right now is within critical infrastructure, just because we have a lot of critical infrastructure was built around the same time as the government built theirs, but critical infrastructure doesn't always have the same amount of funding that the government has sometimes and sometimes doesn't, and it depends on the year, but I think that it's really important that the federal government really starts to step up and help out the, what is it? I think it's 26 critical infrastructure areas that have been identified by CISA. And I think that, that's where I'm most worried about, because attacking, if a bad guy was to attack the federal government, that's obvious. So if I were a bad guy, I'd attack like a water system somewhere.
You know, it's really funny. After I left the Navy and before I worked for that telecommunication company, I worked for 7 years where I got my degrees at a manufacturing company, right? And what we did in those 7 years is we modernized from analog technologies to digital technologies. And if you know anything about about big industries, right? That's just from the time I did that in the 90s till now is just about the life cycle of those tools, right? So they were PLCs, they're digital, you know, they have and they were not designed to be on a network, but they have become placed on the network over years. And now with advances in you know, the adversary's advances, let's just put that, and the lack of deep inspection of the technologies that we built in the 90s, I'll just say that as the other side of it, right? There's a lot of, you'll see that CIS is publishing a lot of OT vulnerabilities, ICS vulnerabilities all the time. I don't think that industry is like necessarily worse, you know, worse than any other industry. It's just they have longer time frames of their delivery. And many of these technologies were developed for constrained environments. So you had to be really careful about they just didn't have a lot of processing power, right? So they built minimal things and the network stacks were built, you know, kind of a long time ago and they weren't updated. And all of those things, you know, in the OT environment lead to the need to really spend some time. So I think you're right. Critical infrastructure is a really important sector that didn't get a whole lot of attention. Now it is. And I'll just say, look, CIS is really front and center there. My colleague Greg Bastian is out at Idaho National Labs. They're doing a lot of ICS work out there. They actually have training labs that can help people come to learn how to look for cybersecurity weaknesses and how to cover them up out of that lab. You know, CISA really does a yeoman job in so many of these areas.
Yeah, I mean, there's a White House memo that just came out yesterday about cybersecurity priorities, and the first line of it was really critical infrastructure. I think you're right. And I mean, I think part of it is like, you know, all of the critical infrastructure in the US, there's a lot of mainframes in the background because that's what was built when those companies started, you know, and so we have to figure out the best way to protect them. Because it can be scary.
And I, you know, I don't know if things have changed from the 90s when, you know, I was involved in the, you know, when the Y2K thing was coming along, right? Those mainframes were something that were there then, right? And, you know, I guess I remember I told you I was working on doing some web things then. So what I would do is I would recommend people find a way to put web front ends in front of the mainframes, isolate the mainframes behind that, have a, you know, Unix LPAR, log in with strong authentication of Unix LPAR. And then, you know, because those mainframes, they don't generally accept long passwords, right? You know what I mean? So there are techniques that I don't know if they've changed much, but there are techniques you can use to isolate the mainframes, to put the dynamic part of your interaction with your users in, you know, in modern technologies. And then allow the mainframes to do what they do best, which is, man, they crunch data like nobody's business, right? And they do it really effectively. I mean, I remember that we used to use the term there were transaction safe paths in the mainframes, and you know, you could actually make sure that if somebody's doing this transaction, it's going to go to completion, right? And you don't have to worry about, you know, anything happening as long as you're taking that transaction set, right? Because it guarantees proper fulfillment.
Yeah, no, you're right. All right. Well, I think we are about out of time. So my question for you, which I've loved talking to you, of course, I always love talking to you. But my question for you is like, what is your one final takeaway of like leaving the government and getting ready to go back into the private sector and take what you learned from the government to the private sector? What is it that you think your big takeaway is?
So I'm going to say that those things help each other, right? I've
Yeah.
been moved from private sector to public sector and back to private sector. each time I'm able to take something. Right now, I'll be taking really deep understanding of what CIS is trying to do to help organizations modernize, to take what I know is the biggest themes about risk that we've learned, right? To do things like, CIS has the known exploited vulnerabilities database, for instance, right? It goes beyond just, we know all the CVEs that are out there. CISA goes deeper and says, okay, but these are the ones we know are being exploited right now. So being able to use all the indicators of operational excellence, right? And make sure you're aligning with that, right? The key here is all about having good consciousness about what's going on and the things you do with intention, right? To make sure that you're not just trying to go through some client compliance checklist, that everything you do, you're doing because you know you need to do it. There's a risk that you're trying to mitigate, and be very intentional about the risk you're mitigating, and then move on to the next risk, right? Take your highest risks and go after them, and then go to the next one.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. I love it. Wonderful takeaway from you. Thank you so much, Ross, for joining us today. And I look forward to seeing you in person soon, hopefully.
And I am an identaholic, so I appreciate you doing this, Christine.
Oh, thanks, Ross. All right. Thanks a lot. And we'll talk soon. Bye.